Okay, this evening, we take a look at Parsha Shmini, and it's one of those years where Shmini is before Pesach, and the Parsha begins with the Yom HaShmini itself. And there is, of course, the question of what Yom HaShmini means. As soon as we say Yom HaShmini, it's the eighth day, that tells us that this is a day following 7 days. And indeed, that is the case. For the 7 days that it follows are what are called the Miluim days, the days of, preparation for the Mishkan. In terms of the dates, as we have noted a number of times, the opinion of Rashi, based on the Taras Kohanim, is that the Yom HaShmini was actually Rosh Chodesh Nisan. It was the first of a number of things, including the first of the month. So the first day of the operation of the Mishkan is the first of Nisan, which means that the seven Miluim days were actually the last 7 days of Adar, which actually, I think, begin either today or tomorrow. So this is the approach of Rashi. Others say that the seven Miluim days were the first 7 days of Nisan, and the Yom HaShmini was the eighth of Nisan, but for Rashi, it is the last 7 days of Adar, and the first of Nisan is the Yom HaShmini. And there are special korbanos for this Yom HaShmini. Korbanos which are unique to this opening day. And that's very interesting, therefore, as far as we can, as helpfully as we can, to note that the eighth day had special korbanos, unique to that day. But the entire seven Miluim days also had unique korbanos. Are they unique in the same way? Or are there differences between them? And if there are, what do those differences reflect? And this is something which is discussed by Reb Leib Mintzberg Zatzal in the Sefer Ben Melech. And he begins by noting two significant differences between the special korbanos of the Miluim days and the special korbanos of the Yom HaShmini. I think it's especially worthwhile because so much attention is given in the Psukim to these korbanos. So without going into each and every one, but at least to get a sense of what they say about the nature of those days. The first difference, says Rav Mintzberg, that we note is what type of korban was prominent and how can we tell? We assume that the bigger the korban, that is to say, the bigger the type of species that's used, the more that is considered prominent or dominant within the day. And in fact, during the seven Miluim days, the largest korban was a chatos. Okay, par, which is the cow or the bull, or as my father used to say, par for the course. But the par is the largest of the korbanos, and that is a chatos. There were sin offerings. There were also olos, burnt offerings, and shlamim, peace offerings. They come from smaller species, and it seems therefore that the primary theme of these 7 days is that of chatos. That's the leading korban, the sin offering. In contrast to that, on the Yom HaShmini, we find that the chatos is de-emphasized. You no longer have a par, the full-grown cow for the chatos. It's rather an eagle, a smaller. Of course, eagle has its own eagle associations, but the chatos is smaller. And actually, it's the ola and the shlomim that seem to take over. They are more numerous and also of larger species. So that is the first thing to consider. Why is it that the korban that leads, the motif korban, shall we say, in the seven preparatory days is a chatos, while that of the eighth day is ola, and in fact even more in the direction of shlomim, of the peace offerings? The second difference, says Rav Mintzberg, is that for the entire 7 days, the Miluim days, all of the korbanos are brought from the Kohanim. meaning there is no input from the Jewish people in these 7 days. Often we have, you know, the Kohen has his Korban, and then the people have their Korban. It's the Kohen that performs the Avodah for both, but they do come from different places. The Korbanos of the people, Korbanos of the Kohanim. The 7 Miluim days only have Korbanos of Kohanim. In contrast to that, in the Yom HaShmini, there actually are no Korbanos of the Kohanim. Aaron brings his Korbanos, and then the people have their Korbanos. Ve'el b'nei Yisrael tedabe le'mor, they bring such and such for their Korbanos. So what is it all about? And it's especially important to ask this question because it's easy to merge these two time frames together. After all, the Mishkan is beginning, so you've got your 7 introductory days, and then you've got this another starting day. So what is it, for all their similarity, and for all their affinity with each other, what is the uniqueness of each? And Rav Mintzberg, as he so often does with his kind of way of looking at things, explains the difference between them. The goal of the Miluim is in order to prepare the Kohanim to attain their newfound status as the ones who will be doing the Avodah. It's Hakshara. It is getting them to that state where they are able to function as Kohanim. And it takes 7 days. From a certain point of view, the Mishkan hasn't yet started. The Kohanim need to get into their status to be ready for when the Mishkan will begin. Ironically, they need the Mishkan in order to do that, because their preparedness, more correctly, preparation, will come in the form of doing the Avodah of Korbanos, which needs a Mishkan. But the Mishkan is there in order for the Kohanim to become Kohanim fully, not yet for the Mishkan to be operating. The Yom HaShmini, by contrast, is the first day that the Mishkan is actually up and running as a Mishkan. Now, of course, that will require special korbanos just because it's day one. But it is day one of 2, 3, and 4 and all the days to follow. If we could put it slightly differently, which might be helpful in terms of our parlance. The difference between the 7 Miluim days and the 8th day of the Yom HaShmini is that the Miluim days were days of initiation. The 8th day was a day of inauguration. That's a different atmosphere. It's a different state. And therefore, the 7 days of initiating the Kohanim into Kahuna, but the Mishkan itself has not begun, not fully. Day one of the Mishkan as Mishkan is the Yom HaShmini. And it's very interesting to see how this is reflected also in the words of Chazal. There's a famous Medrash. Rashi references the Medrash. He doesn't quote it in its entirety. The Medrash says, there's also Gemara actually in Shabbos in the ninth Perek, that the Yom HaShmini, it had 10 crowns. Eser Atoros Notal Oso Hayom. There were 10 crowns associated with the Yom HaShmini. And by 10 crowns, we mean it was 10 firsts. And they all came together. And some of them are quite well known to us. It was the first day of the week. And it was the first day of the month, again, according to Rashi for the Taras Kohanim. So there's a number of firsts that we're familiar with. But the Medrash also says, Rishon leKehuna. It's the first day of Kehuna. Rishon leAvoda. It's the first day of Avoda. Now, that seems to be very interesting because we would say it's the 8th day of Avodah. What have the last 7 days been, if not days of Kahuna and Avodah? But rather, says Rav Mintzberg, you understand that those are preparatory days. The Kohanim are becoming Kohanim. The Avodah is there in order to allow them to do that. But the first day when they actually act in the capacity of fully invested Kohanim is the Yom HaShmini, when the preparation is over. And the first day of the Avodah in the full sense of the word, as avoda, not as a way to get them to become kohanim, but what they became kohanim for, to do the avoda, that first day is also the Yom HaShmini. And this will explain further, says Rav Mintzberg, an interesting thing, I think it's quite well known. The Seder Olam says that during the 7 days of the Miluim, so the Mishkan needed to be up and running for the Kohanim to do their avoda and bring their korbanos. But at the end of the day, each day, says the Seder Olam, Moshe would take the Mishkan down. And that's very interesting. Only on the eighth day did he set up the Mishkan and kept it up. But why take it down during those 7 days? I mean, you're going to need it tomorrow. It's day two. You'll need it for day three, four, five, and six, and seven. So why take it down each time? But this is to further underscore, says Rav Mintzberg, that the Mishkan isn't up yet. It's not up and running in this way. You need it for these korbanos, but as soon as the korbanos are finished, the Mishkan comes down again because it isn't really established yet. It's only on the Yom HaShemini that it will be up and up to stay. To stay, of course, until the Jewish people travel to a new location. But this is why it was taken down each day. It purely served the Kohanim to enter their capacity as Kohanim, but it wasn't really the Mishkan standing per se. And finally, Achar HaDvarim Ha'ele, says Rav Mintzberg, we can understand why the central korban, as we mentioned, the primary korban for the 7 days of the Miluim was the Chatos. Because the goal there is in order to make the Kohanim eligible to achieve their new status. And whenever a person goes from a relatively mundane status, or a lower status, quote-unquote, to a higher one, he will need a Chatos in order to fully purify him and launch him and make him eligible to step into this higher state. And therefore, because the focus of the 7 days of the Miluim are the Kohanim mean to prepare themselves, maximum preparation for this more elevated state is the Chatos to allow them to do that. By contrast, on the Yom HaShmini, the Kohanim are now Kohanim, and it's Avoda now. So on the contrary, these are days of celebration. The first day of the Mishkan, it's Yom Chasunasu, Yom Simchas Libo. And therefore, the focus is much more on the Olos and on the Shlomim, which are much, I wouldn't say friendlier, but certainly don't have the overtones of in any way having done something wrong or could do better or any such things. The focus is this, are the celebratory korbanos, because the Yom HaShmini is finally the day of celebration. Of course, and in conclusion, we note, these are not exclusive to each other. The Chatos aspect, the sin offering aspect, and the Shlom and peace offering aspect, they're not exclusive to each other. It's not a binary thing, as if to say, make up your mind. You're either going to bring a Chatos, or you're going to bring a shlomim. In the end, both were in both. Both the 7 preparatory days and the 8th day had all of these 3 types of korbanos. Because in the end, you always need all the elements. The only question is, which is prominent? Which means on the 7 preparatory days of the Miluim, you had Ola and Shlomim also, because there's a celebratory aspect to the Kohanim becoming Kohanim. But because they are becoming Kohanim through this, the focus is on the Chatos. Likewise, on the 8th day, of course, the focus is on the Shlomim and the celebration. But the Jewish people are also moving into a new state of people with Mishkan. And therefore, there's a Chatos there. It's not as prominent as it was in the first 7 days, but it is present nonetheless. So these are the very wonderful comments and insights of Rav Mintzberg into what otherwise would, I think, seem a litany of korbanos, one after the other, without ever seeing them as a window into the character of these two time frames, the 7 Miluim days and the Yom HaShmini. Well, not only have the Kohanim become Kohanim, Aaron is the Kohen Gadol, and he will have what to do on the 8th day as well. And in Pasuk Vav, pardon me, Pasuk Zayin, Perek Tes, Pasuk Zayin, we read, Vayomer Moshe el Aaron. So Moshe says to Aaron, Kerav el HaMizbeach, approach the Mizbeach, Va'aseyes Chatoscha, Va'asolasecha, it's to bring your korbanos, V'chaper bat chavad ha'am, atone for yourself and the people, Va'aseyes korban ha'am, V'chaper ba'adam, and also bring the korbanos of the people. So this is very interesting. We have a pasuk, this pasuk Zion of Perek Tes, is dedicated, or devoted, to telling us that Moshe told Aaron to approach the Mizbeach and to perform the Avodah. What is the background to this instruction from Moshe? Aaron doesn't go until Moshe tells him to go. Rashi cites a Medrash. He actually cites part of a Medrash. We'll read Rashi and then we'll reference the Medrash, which is the source. Because actually, and it's very interesting that Rashi notes this, When the Pasuk says that Moshe told Aaron to approach the Mizbeach, it's because Aaron didn't want to approach the Mizbeach. He was hesitant. He was reluctant. Why? Rashi says, Shehaya Aaron bosh v'yarei lageshes. Aaron was ashamed and was afraid to approach. Amala Moshe. Moshe says, Lamata Bosh. Why are you embarrassed? Lachach Nivcharta. For this you have been chosen. So, we understand, Rashi's informed us, Aaron was reluctant, but Moshe said, there's no need to be embarrassed or ashamed. This is what you were chosen for. What is the background? So Rashi has quoted the amount that he's quoted, and Rashi's job as Rashi has done. But if we consult the Medrash, as many Mephorshim lead us back to the Medrash itself, we find a very interesting thing. Aaron, the reason why he was ashamed, I mean, one perhaps may surmise, maybe one shouldn't surmise, but the Medrash says the reason why Aaron was embarrassed is because he saw something in the fire. Right, the fire which was already there waiting for the korbanos, Aaron saw an image of a calf in the fire. And of course, for Aaron to see that, that's a sign for Aaron that maybe the calf is still an issue. Aaron's relationship with the Chet HaEgel is very, very complicated. Even that is an oversimplification. But as we know from the pasuk, he made the egel in order to keep the people at bay, in order to delay them, to defer them, with many, many other elements as well. But at the end of the day, Aaron physically was involved in making the egel. And now, as he looks at the fire, in the fire is an image of a calf. For Aaron, takes that as a sign that maybe he's not wanted. So Moshe needs to encourage him. Don't worry. L'chach nivcharta, for this you have been chosen. What is the meaning of this medrash? And where does this image come from of the calf? A very fascinating explanation of this medrash is to be found in a commentary called Mincha Belula. I do not believe we've quoted it before. Mincha Belula was written in the 1500s. By someone called Rav Avraham Menachem Rappaport. Rappaport is a well-known name, and as far as I know, the one who actually composed that name was Rav Avraham Menachem of Rappaport. His family was of German origin. The family is originally Rappa, which is somehow associated with ravens. And when they came to Italy, and they settled in the town of Porto, so in order to combine the two ideas, he was the one that actually fused them, and hence the name Rappaport, Rappa and Porto. The Mincha Belula says a very fascinating thing. What does the Medrash tell us? Aaron looks at the fire, and in the fire he sees the image of a calf. Where does that image come from? Why is he seeing that? So the Mincha Belula says, you know, if you look in the fire, And fire constantly changes shape. And it doesn't really have much form. So what do you see? You see what's on your mind. And it's a projection of sorts, which is an amazing thing. And therefore, here's Aaron, and he looks at the fire, and many people could look at the fire and see different things. Aaron looks at the fire and he sees a calf. But what does that mean? It means that Aaron is constantly aware of his involvement in the Chet HaEgel. Again, with all of the explanations that we gave. But for him, it weighs on him. And when he looks at a fire, he sees the calf. But if that's true, what then is Moshe's response? Moshe says to him, L'chach nivcharta. L'chach nivcharta, which we have translated, I think, mildly as, for this you have been chosen, mean you've been chosen to do the avoda. But the Mincha Belula says, L'chach nivcharta means it was for this reason you were chosen. Meaning the very reason that you see a calf in the flames is the reason you were chosen. Because you should be conscious, right? It should weigh on you. And it's for that very reason that you are the one who will take the avoda with all of its seriousness, there'll be no complacency and there'll be no flippancy and there'll be nothing other than the contrition and the awe that the avoda demands. So l'chach nivcharta means the very reason, or the very fact that you do see the calf is itself the reason you were chosen, because it's good. What would the alternative be? What if you looked in the fire and you saw something else, and had you forgotten about your involvement in the calf? Maybe you wouldn't have been chosen, because it's not right for you to forget about it. You should be mindful of it and proceed accordingly. And it's for that very reason that you will give these matters the respect and the reverence that they deserve. It's a very interesting perish of the Medrash. I'll say, puts me in mind of a Maisa. This I heard from my father's Zatzal, when Rabbi Zalman Meltzer was offered the Rabbonus. He was the Rav in Slutsk. I'm not sure if that was his first Rabbonus, but when he was offered his first post of Rabbonus, he didn't want to take it. But he went to his Rebbe. His Rebbe was Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. Reb Chaim taught him in the Voloshin Yeshiva. And he took Eitzah with Reb Chaim and said, they're offering me this Rabbonus and I don't want to take it. So Reb Chaim Soloveitchik says, why don't you want to take it? Why don't you want to take the job? He says, because a Rav needs to be a postdoc. I'm afraid to paskin. What if I make a mistake in halacha? As long as I'm a private citizen, so it's just, it's me, it's my household. As soon as I'm a Rav for a shtot, so then... it's an achrayus, and I'm afraid to make a mistake. So Reb Chaim Soloveitchik says, that's exactly the reason why you should take the job. Because if you don't take the job, you know who's going to become the rabbi? A rabbi who's not afraid to make a mistake. That will be a disaster. You should be afraid to make a mistake, but you still need to take the job. And if you're afraid, good, so then you'll be careful. So it's a very similar to Lahavda, but again, Lahavda bin Kodesh Lakodesh. With this explanation of the Medrash, in other words, you should be mindful of it. Good, but that's the reason to engage. So these are the comments with regards to Aaron on the Yom HaShmini. As we know, the Yom HaShmini was marred by the death of the two sons of Aaron. It really, really was a very multi-layered day. And their death is, well, the episode is described in the beginning of Perek Yud. Perek Yud, Pasuk Aleph. Vayikhu b'nei Aaron Nadav v'Abihu Ishmachta. So what does the Pasuk tell us? With that we have to begin. Each one takes their fire pan, which is where the Keteris would be offered, or the fire, more correctly, coals. Vayitnu v'han Eish. And they put fire on it, vayasimu alei haketeres, and then they put the ingredients of the keteres, vayakrivu lefnei Hashem eish zara asher lo tziva osam. And they offered before Hashem a foreign fire that he had not commanded them. And the next pasuk, retribution was swift incoming. Pasuk Beis, Vateitze Eish Minifnei Hashem, Vatochel Osam, when fire came out from before Hashem, consumed them. Vayamusu Lifnei Hashem. So this is, it happens that quickly. Even as you read it, in 2 Pesukim, it's done. And we need to try and get a sense of what happened. What was the wrongdoing? And what was it that was so deserving of such a decisive punishment? It's interesting to note that the death of Nadav and Avihu, which is described here, is also mentioned three other times in the Chumash. And each time it always has some type of accompanying commentary similar to what we just read here. In the beginning of Chumash Bamidbar, where you have a counting of the people, and Nadav and Avihu are mentioned, but then it says that they died. In Perek Gimel Pasuk Dalet, and it says they died b'hakrivam eish zara lifnei Hashem. They offered eish zara. Again, the phrase from our pasuk is mentioned again there. It doesn't just say that they died; it says that they died when they offered an eish zara before Hashem. So, too, at the end of Chumash Bamidbar, because Bamidbar is bracketed by countings in the Parshas Bamidbar in the beginning and Parshas Pinchas at the end. And in Perek Kaf Vav, Pasuk Samach Aleph, likewise, Vayamas Nadav Va'avihu, they're mentioned initially, but then it says they died, Bahakrivam Eish Zara Lifnei Hashem. So far, we have seen three psukim, and they all say the same thing, Hakrivam Eish Zara Lifnei Hashem, is far and far before Hashem. The fourth time, which actually I think is the most well-known time, because it's actually lain the most, it's the very beginning of Parshas Acharemos. Acharemos Shnei Bnei Aaron. Right? Once again, the death of Bnei Aaron. There it says, Bikorvasam Lifnei Hashem Vayamusu. They drew close to Hashem and they died. It doesn't mention Eish Zara. This is the one out of the four that doesn't mention Eish Zara. I think it's better known to us because it's Rishon of Acharemos, which means it's lained on Sheni V'chamishi. It's also the laning for Yom Kippur morning. So if we try and understand what's behind this, I mean, we know that there's two components to what they did. They put a fire that they weren't asked to, but they also put ketores. So the question is, which was the significant sin? Meaning, which was the essential problem? The fire or the ketores? Or maybe both. But here, we see that Mefarshim seem to be somewhat divided. The Sephorno addresses this question. And again, it's so enigmatic. The Pasuk doesn't really describe when, where, what. It says that they brought Ketores. Was this the regular Ketores of the morning? Was this an additional Ketores? The Sephorno, Pasuk doesn't say. More correct, the Pasuk doesn't specify. This Forno is of the understanding that this was an extra Ketores that they decided to bring. The morning Ketores had been brought, but they decided to bring an extra Ketores, and that is all called the foreign fire, meaning effectively the problem was they brought more Ketores. And why is that so problematic? Firstly, why did they do that? What motivated them to do this? Says the Sforno, the Ketores is always accompanies the apprehension of the Shechina, of the divine presence. So when you bring a korban in the morning, in the afternoon, the korban talmud, you also offer Ketores. On this eighth day, as we're told earlier in the parsha, there was a very pronounced vision or apprehension of Kvod Hashem. So the divine presence was there, so to speak, in greater measure than it would be on a normal day. And commensurate with this, or in keeping with this, Nadav and Avihu felt it's appropriate that if the divine presence is there to a certain degree, bring korbanos. So if it's there to a great ketores, pardon me, if it's there to a greater degree, so bring more ketores. But as the Sforno concludes, or as the Pasuk concludes, as the Sforno, but they were not told to do this. And to offer Ketores, where you're not meant to offer Ketores, is is a great problem. But to understand where they were coming from, but for the Sforno, the problem was in the extra Keteres. The Torah says you can't offer Keteres beyond on the Mizbeach of the Keteres beyond what is mandated by the Torah. The Rashbam, and going back a little bit, right? The Rashbam to the Rishonim understands that this Keteres was actually the morning Keteres. So the problem is not in the Keteres itself. You got to bring Keteres in the morning and the afternoon. This was the normal morning Keteres. The problem was in the fire. Except, the Keteres needs fire. So why is the fire that accompanied the Keteres called an Esh Zara, a foreign fire, that Hashem did not command? The reason, says Rashbam, is because even though it's true that on subsequent days, indeed, the Kohen would provide the fire for the Keteres, he would take it from the Mizbeach. However, on this day, as the Pasuk says, they were not told to do that. They were not told to do that because on this first day, Hashem wanted everything, all of the fire, to come down from on high in a much more manifest expression of the Shekhinah, in the same way that Eliyahu and Har HaKarmel. I mean, how did he demonstrate whose korban was the korban that Hashem had chosen? The fire would come down from on high. And indeed, this is what happened in Pasuk Kaf Dalet of Perek Tes, the final Pasuk of Perek Tes, Vateitze Eish Melefnei Hashem, Vatochal Al HaMizbeach. The Pasuk describes, a fire came down. It's like Eliyahu Bahar HaKarmel, or it's reversed. Eliyahu was like this. A fire came down and consumed the Korbanos on the Mizbeach. They should have understood, says Rashbam, that a similar fire would come down in order to deal with the Keteres. And that would have been a much greater Kiddush Hashem, which they diminished by offering their own fire. That's not for today. Today is a special day. And in a sense, they diminished the special quality of the day. And that was sufficient enough to warrant a very drastic punishment for them. So if we can summarize, and of course, each of these explanations, it needs further eon, Kedivrei Rishonim. But for the Sforno, the problem was the extra Keteres that they felt was in place, but which was not in place. And for the Rashbam, it's the providing of the fire of themselves, when in fact the fire was meant to be provided from on high. Either way, and if we could synopsize the difference between them, is the problem in the Keteres aspect or in the Esh Zara aspect? Having said all this, we should note, and we do know this, that Chazal, both in the Gemara and in the Medrash, they identify what we could call, I wouldn't say additional or other problems with Nadav and Avihu, and identify them as the, seemingly, as the sin, as the source of the wrongdoing. Rashi quotes both of them. Two of them. There's many of them. It's got to be at least half a dozen. Rashi on Pasuk Beis, and it's very interesting. We start with Pasuk Beis. Vateitze Eish, Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Shilomesu bnei Aaron, Ela al yudei shehoru halacha bifnei Moshe Rabban. Why did they die? Because they issued halachic ruling in front of Moshe, their teacher. That's based on the Gemara. It's a Gemara in Erevin. Rabbi Shmuel Omer, Rashi brings the second Peirush, thus far Rabbi Lezer, now Rabbi Shmuel, Shesuya Yayin Nichnasu LaMikdash. They entered having partaken of wine. It doesn't say that they were Shikorim, but Shesuya Yayin. And interestingly, that will be mentioned later on, but it had not something that was commanded, presumably it's something they should have known. It's mentioned in the psukim that follow. So it wasn't said to them, seemingly. But they should have known. They should have known better, and that's a second explanation. But as Meforshim point out, and there are other explanations, and they didn't take Eitzah from each other, and they didn't wash their hands before they went to the Avoda. Numerous things. But the shaina that all the mafarshim are grappling with is, if we could borrow an expression from Megillas Esther that we read not too long ago, ma'ra'u al kacha. What did Chazal see to present these additional wrongdoings? I mean, the pasuk, as much as the pasuk isn't absolutely specific or explicit in terms of what the problem was, but it certainly tells you what the problem wasn't. I mean, whatever it will be, it will have to answer seemingly to the issue of the Keteris and the Eishet Zara. I mean, those are things that are mentioned explicitly in the Pasuk. And you look in the Gemara, Mer Halacha Bifnei Rambo, and then they drank wine before they went in. And none of this has anything to do with not the Keteris and not Eishet Zara. So why is everyone looking further afield? And many answers are given, but I believe perhaps a simple and direct answer to this question. We noted that the pasuk, whenever it talks about the death of Nadav and Avihu, it always says, it accompanies it with the words, Bakrivam Esh Zara or Bakar Basam Lefnei Hashem. It always says that. The question is, what is the relationship between the Esh Zara and their deaths? We assume it's the cause. It's the reason. The problem is, Behakrivam is not an expression or does not denote a reason. Behakrivam is a description. When it happened. But that doesn't say why it happened. If we think about all the other, I'm not sure how many there are, but just for a case of comparison, when Moshe is told that he can't go into the land of Canaan as a result of the Mei Meriva, it doesn't say Behakoso or something like that, when he did. It says, because he did. Ya'an, because. Al Asher, because. Right? These are expressions of because you do that. This is why. The Pasuk never says that they died al asher hikrivu esh zara, because they offered esh zara. It never says because, it says when. But what does that mean? It means that whatever the reason is, that is a reason that might not have killed them had they not been in a state of offering esh zara before Hashem. In other words, the contribution to their demise of offering either the Keteris or Eish Zara Lefnei Hashem and getting closer, that itself is not necessarily the reason why they died. But whatever was the reason could then happen to them. Because that is an extremely sensitive situation. That is an extremely delicate setting. If you are before Hashem, involved in a korban that you weren't asked to be involved in, or doing something that you weren't, but here you are presenting yourself in this most sensitive of settings, it could be that there are certain wrongdoings that had you stayed outside, so maybe they would have not reared their heads. But now that you're inside, in this very, very sensitive situation, so then the vulnerability, or the susceptibility, more correctly, to retribution for wrongdoing has become immeasurably heightened. I think that is the explanation of why so many other things are mentioned beyond what the Pasuk says, because the Pasuk isn't identifying the reason. It's only describing the setting where such a reason could actually make a difference. But the chet's got to be something else. It's going to be Horu Halacha Bifnei Rabbo or something like that. And why is it indeed that Rashi chooses these two explanations, right, having partaken of wine and Horu Halacha Bifnei Rabban? Interestingly, on Pasuk Aleph of Perek Yud, which describes them taking the Keteris and the foreign fire, Rashi doesn't comment at all. Which further, in a sense, highlights that the wrongdoing didn't lie there. That's just where the wrongdoing could land. But when Pasuk bases that the fire came out, Rashi says we need to explain why. Because the Pasuk hasn't explained why yet. It's just explained where, in what situation. Well, why would Rashi choose these two? So for that, we go back to the methodology of Rashi. And Rashi himself explains why he quotes the issue of Shesuye Yayin, for the very reason that the very next thing that is mentioned is the prohibition against doing the avoda whilst having drunk, as that's in Pasuk Tes. Vayedaber Hashem el Aaron lemor. The pasuk expresses it as Hashem speaking to Aaron. Yayin v'shechar al teish tatov v'necha itach bevoachem el oam mu'ed v'lo samusu. Don't do that, right? V'lo samusu. Your sons didn't know, but I'm telling you now, and they didn't know, but they again, it's Asia Zara, so then things were much more sensitive. But the proximity of this instruction and this prohibition with that episode, that's enough to tip us off, says Rashi, that's what it was about. That certainly gives entry to that one explanation. And what about the second explanation? That Horu Halacha Bifnei Rabo, and they kind of saw themselves somewhat above their station, if I may use blunt terminology. But why would Rashi see, where does Rashi see in the Pasuk that's what's happening? So one of the Mefarshim explains a very interesting thing. So you see again the precision of the Lashon HaKodesh in Pasuk Aleph. Okay, Perik Yud, Pasuk Aleph. Vayikru v'nei Aharon, Nodav and Aviyu, Ish Machtoso, right, v'nei Aharon, Nodav and Aviyu. Each one took his machto, his fire pan, they put their fire, ketores, so on and so forth. The key lies in the opening words, the first five words of the Pasuk. And they just seem to be names. What's been revealed here? But consider a most compelling point. Generally speaking, whenever a person is introduced in the Chumash, Tzei Ulamad, the rule is, first you'll hear his name, and then you'll hear who he was. A classic example, Yisro. Yisro, and who's Yisro? Kohen Midyan, Chosen Moshe. You start with a name, then tell me who he was. And so on and so forth. In keeping with this, it should have said, Vayikru Nadav Avihu B'nei Aaron Ishmachtasa. We've never seen Nadav and Avihu mentioned by name yet. We are now being introduced to them as individuals. As such, the pasuk should have said, "Vayikru Nadav and Avihu, who were Bnei Aaron, etc., and so forth." Lo and behold, the descriptions have been inverted. Halo Davarhu. And what does it teach us? It teaches us that normally, the standard is this is who they are, and this is their station, shall we say. Who are Nadav and Avihu? They're Bnei Aaron. But by inverting them, we're being indicated that they were Bnei Aaron, but they weren't happy with that. They were looking to move away from that, to graduate from being Bnei Aaron in the shadow of their father, or those who are their elders and betters, to become Nadav and Avihu. That's a progression. They're moving, they're looking to move from being Bnei Aaron to Nadav and Avihu, people in their own right. How will that express itself? Mor halacha b'fnei rabo. I know the halacha, why can't I say? The Rebbe's here, but I know just as well. It's an amazing sensitivity to the Lashon. It's so easy to read these words and not to see that all the people, all the times, you have the name and the description. The name will always precede the description. This is the exception, and that's the lesson to him. Well, from here, if we move to the second half of the parsha, we're actually going to focus on one letter. The second half of the parsha deals, among other things, with macholos asurim, right, with kosher and non-kosher food. But actually, there is one letter which has received a lot of attention towards the end of Parsha Shemini, and that is in Perik Yud Aleph Pasuk Mem Beis, and it's for the following reason. There, as the Pasuk describes, the type of shirotzim that one could eat and one can't eat, and these are things, of course, which we don't necessarily have that much familiarity with anymore. We certainly know what's not okay, we just don't know what's yes okay. And it says, kol holech al gachon, anything that slithers on its belly, which is a reference to a snake, sheker tzulachem. The Gemara in Maseches Kiddushin, on Daf Kavtes, talks about, or Daf Lamed, talks about the letters of the Torah. And it explains that the reason why the Chachamim were called Sofrim, we talk about the Rabbanan as Divrei Sofrim, that they would keep an accounting of the letters. So much so that they inform us that the Vav in the word gachon, again, the phrase is kol holech al gachon. Gachon is the belly. The Vav of gachon is the middle letter in the Torah. And that propelled this Vav now to fame as the middle letter of the Torah. Many, many Mefarshim comment on this Gemara because there were certain people who undertook, even before nowadays when it's very easy to do stuff like a letter count, who undertook to count the letters of the Torah. And they discovered that their finding of the middle letter of the Torah is about 5,000 letters before we reach the Vav of Gachon. So the question is how to relate to this. It is true that Gemara says that to a certain degree, we don't always know which letters are what's called Male and Chaser. Male and Chaser. Should it have a Vav? If it says whatever the word, Cholem, should it be Cholem with a Vav, without a Vav? So we don't know. But this seems to be extremely not knowing. I mean, to the tune of even 5,000 cases, which is very not knowing. And many Mefarshim are reluctant to take it to that degree. So the question, therefore, that remains is how do we understand what the Gemara is saying? The truth is that this relates to another question, which I think that what we're about to quote is probably better known than the Gemara, even though it's from the Zohar, or maybe because. And that is, the Zohar says, was famous for saying, that there are 600,000 letters in the Torah. Shishim ribo osios. And the Mefarshim, the Mekubalim, that is to say, explain that each person, he has, each Jew of the 600,000 is connected to one of the letters. Yisrael, says the Magale Amukos, Reb Nosson Shapira, Yisrael is the Rosh HaTevis, Yesh Shishim ribo osios la Torah. Because the 600,000, it's quoted by the Pnei Yeshua in Kiddushin there, the 600,000 letters correspond to the 600,000 Jewish people. Here, too, we run into a problem, and it's not, one doesn't even need to count all the letters in order to see that there will be a problem here. You just need to imagine, if you know how many psukim there are, it's very clear that there are not going to be 600,000 letters in the Torah. Those who did count them basically saw that there is just over half of this amount. Specifically, 304,805. We know that the 600,000 also is not exactly 600,000, but it's 600,000 plus minus. But this is just over half of that. So once again, to try and get a sense of what the Gemara is saying, or in this case, what the Zohar means, we'll see the two questions are connected. Why would the Zohar say that the 600,000 letters if there is just over half that amount? And this has been discussed by the great Mefarshim over the generations. Reb Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the Balatanya, the first Chabad Rebbe, in his Sefer on Chumash called Likutei Torah in Parshas Bahar, so he explains as follows. His approach is that when the Zohar talks about a letter, we need to broaden our horizons a little bit. According to everyone, we're going to have to broaden our horizons. The only question is, in which direction? But the Baal HaTanya says that what's interesting about Lashon HaKodesh, I'm not sure if it's unique, but certainly distinctive, is that the vowels come in as punctuation points. Certainly if you'd compare that Lahavdil with other languages, where a vowel is a letter, which means if you have a komatz or a patach, so in another language, that would be a letter. It would be an O or an A, and so on and so forth. And therefore, the Balatanya suggests that when the Zohar says there's 600,000 letters in the Torah, it means all told, everything that tells you how this is to be mentioned, including punctuation, which is in lieu of letters, not punctuation, vowelization, which is in lieu of letters. The patach is like a letter, the comments is like a letter, and that will get you in the region of the 600,000. So for the Balatanya, it's the vowels. They also need to be part of the cheshbon. A little earlier, or more than a little earlier than the Balatanya, because the Balatanya is in the late 1700s, you have Rabbi Shlomo Al-Ghazi, one of the great Turkish gedolim. He's in the 1500s, Maharash Al-Ghazi, and he explains differently. The way to understand how the 600,000 letters in the Torah, even for us, is just over half that amount, is to understand that many of the letters are actually considered composite letters. That means, for example, that if you look at a vav, it's just a vav. And if you look at a yud, it's just a yud. But if you look at an aleph, it's not just an aleph. It's a vav with two yuds. And indeed, in the halachos of Safras, that's how the letters are described, the way to relate to them. A base is like a dalet resting on top of a vav. So some letters are like one, some letters are like two, some are even like three, but most are the one and two. And therefore, because each of them is considered to be a unit, and therefore if what we consider to be letters is only 300,000 plus a few more, but if you divide them in that way, Maharash Al-Ghazi suggests that you will once again get to your 600,000. Reb Reuven Margolius, much closer to our time, the great Reb Reuven Margolius, who is each of his sfarim is more wonderful than the next, and they're slim volumes, but they muat machzikas hamaruba. And one of his sfarim is called Hamikra v'Hamasura, and there he explains differently. There is a teaching, of course, if you want to understand the Zohar, so what better than another mystical tradition to explain it? But this actually is quoted by Rashi, what he's about to mention. And that is that the Torah was given, or the original Torah exists in what is known as Eish Shechora Agabi Eish Levona, black fire on white fire. Rashi says this in Parshas Vezos HaBrocha, he cites this, Eish Dos Lomo, Mimino Eish Dos Lomo. Now, what does that mean? Obviously, we don't know ultimately what it means on the higher levels, but what it translates into is that the Mefarshim do say, the words of the Torah that are written on the parchment, the black ink on the white parchment is representative of the black fire on the white fire. The point is that the white fire is also fire. We look upon parchment as perhaps nothing, or the absence of anything, but that's not so. It's fire as surely as the defined black fire is. The white fire also is part of the message of the Torah. Between every word, there's a space of a letter. Between every paragraph, there's another few spaces. Between every chumash, there's a few lines. In the Shiras, you have more blank spaces. Hazinu, az yashir. The more we understand that those spaces representing the white fire are equally part of the Torah's message, and equally part of the ksav, so then they're also to be counted in the minyan. And put it all together, says Reb Reuven Margolius, will take you to, again, the region of 600,000. So these are and actually these are three of many explanations that were given, but these are the ones that I felt were most accessible, at least for myself. Again, for the Balatanya, it's factoring in the vowels in lieu of letters. For Rabbi Shlomo Al-Ghazi, it's to see certain letters as composite letters, which they are. And for Reb Reuven Margolius, it's the spaces in between. A very different approach to all of this, that the Vav of Gachon is the middle letters, was presented by someone called Reb Yitzchak Zilber. Reb Yitzchak Zilber, who may be known as one of the famous rabbinic figures in the last few decades, who came to Eretz Yisrael. He lived in Russia for many years, and he had spent time in Siberia also, and a very, very special person. I had yet the schus of having a Shabbos meal by him once, a truly elevated individual, really in a different realm. But he was also a mathematician, and he approaches the entire matter from a completely different vantage point. We mentioned that the Gemara says that the middle letter is the Vav Halech al Gachon. If you look at the word Gachon there, if you look at that Vav, you will see that it is large, right? Yud, Perik, Yud, Aleph, Pasuk, Mem, Beis. The Vav is large. So we perhaps might be inclined to say, well, the reason why it's large is because it's the middle letter. And just to refer back to what we were saying, perhaps one of the other ways to understand how the 600,000 letters would actually explain why the Vav of Gachon is in the middle, if you know how to configure letters with spaces or with vowels or with so on and so forth. But Rav Zilber says it's the other way round. The causality is reversed. There are numerous letters in the Torah which are of unusual size, either unusually large or unusually small. The Vayikra, the Aleph of Vayikra is famous, and so on and so forth. How many are there in total? 17. There are 70 letters that are of unusual size, either bigger than usual or smaller than usual. One of them is the Vav of Gachon. It's the ninth. It's in the middle of those letters. When the Gemara says the Vav of Gachon is emtsa'on shel osios, it's the middle of the letters, it means it's the middle of those unusual letters. It's number 9 of 17. Not that it's the middle letter in the Torah. And what's very interesting is, Rav Zilber says further, there is another notable point in our parsha, also mentioned by the Gemara, in Perik Yud Pasuk Tet Zayin. The Pasuk says, Darosh Darash Moshe. Thus far, we focused on the middle letter in the Torah. The Gemara says, Darosh Darash is the middle word in the Torah. And here too, count the words. I mean, don't forget to read them, but count them. And if you do, you will see that Darosh Darash does not seem to be the middle. It's certainly not exactly in the middle. It's roundabout, but not exactly in the middle. So what does it mean? Once again, says Rav Zilber, it's the same thing. Darosh Darash is very unusual. It's a double expression. How many of those do we have? He went through the Torah, he counted them. Darosh Darash is the middle of those expressions, words that are doubled over. Ohishova Shivu'ah, or Avram, Avram. If you look at all of those that were repeated, you will see that Darosh Darash is in the middle. Em so'on shel tevos. Very, very interesting. What's further interesting, and this I only found out through conversation, is that subsequently this was published in a Torah periodical by Rabbi Yitzchak Zilber. But when he originally published it, he did not attach his name to it. And the reason why is because he originally published it when he was still in Russia. And it was dangerous for him to attach his name to any Torah publication. So he wrote it anonymously and sent it on. It was only once he came to Eretz Yisrael he was able to put the whole thing together and finally affix his name to it. This was told to me by my uncle Rav Kuperman Zatzal. Rav Kuperman and Rav Yitzchak Zilber were mechutanim. Rav Kuperman's oldest son and Rav Zilber's daughter married. So Rav Kuperman, of course, who had a very broad range of interest in Divrei Torah, he was once talking with Rav Yitzchak Zilber, and he and Rav Kuperman had seen this idea, and he says, I don't know who says this, but it's very interesting. The middle of the unusual size letters, the middle of the double words. Did you ever hear that? And Rav Zilber says, yes, that's my chiddush. And Rav Kuperman said, but it sounded anonymous. He says, I wrote it when I'm in Russia. It was a sakana to put my name to it. But those are my chidushim. So finally, that's how the author was reunited with his Torah. So these are some of the very interesting discussions that are there in Parsha Shmini from the beginning and running through, and certainly a not to contemplate and not to think about. We'll leave it over there for this evening. Wish you a wonderful week. Shabbos Tovos, Leklal v'Leprat. All the very best.